From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The administration of sex and violence continues to rain missiles on the people of Iraq as the House debate on impeachment gets underway in Washington. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The House of Representatives is due to begin a historic debate today on whether to impeach President Clinton for the Monica Lewinsky scandal as bombs continue to rain down on Iraq. House Republican leaders recovering from the stunning revelation that House Speaker-elect Bob Livingston had his own extramarital affairs pushed the impeachment debate back one day after Washington launched major airstrikes against Iraq late on Wednesday. Clinton's chances of avoiding impeachment by the House appear slim, which means he will likely face a trial in the Senate next year. But a two-thirds majority is needed to remove Clinton, a prospect viewed as highly unlikely at this point. Livingston shocked a conference of Republican lawmakers preparing for today's rescheduled impeachment vote by telling them he had strayed from my marriage, quote-unquote, of 33 years, and had received marriage and spiritual counseling. The confession came only hours before the start of today's debate on articles of impeachment. Livingston said he'd discovered individuals working together with the media were trying to, quote, find indiscretions which may be exploitable against me, he said, and my party on the eve of the upcoming historic vote on impeachment. Around 2,000 people joined the Reverend Jesse Jackson yesterday at an anti-impeachment rally on the steps of the Capitol. Along with Jesse Jackson was AFL-CIO President John Sweeney. The audience included labor groups and members of minority and Democratic Party organizations. Jackson said the Republicans are getting ready to effectively void the results of the November elections. Russia has recalled its ambassadors to Washington and London amid mounting polarization in world opinion as the United States and Britain yesterday bombed Iraq for a second night. U.S. planes dropped propaganda leaflets in southern Iraq during yesterday's air raids, this according to an official source at Baghdad's Ministry of Culture and Information. Russian President Boris Yeltsin said yesterday after the initial strikes that they, quote, crudely violated the United Nations Charter and were fraught with the most dramatic consequences for the Gulf region. Russia told the Atlantic Alliance yesterday it hoped the action against Iraq was not a precursor of a new global NATO ready to take unilateral military action wherever it pleased. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright said today she regrets the recall of Russia's ambassador to Washington, but that she will not recall the U.S. ambassador in Moscow. Albright also said she'd heard reports of Russian troop movements and that the purpose of the movements was unclear. The bombings have bitterly divided the five permanent members of the Security Council, leaving them unable to reach any conclusions so long as the attacks continue. The council at some point has to decide whether to press for the return of the arms inspectors to Baghdad or seek a new solution to the impasse over eliminating Iraq's weapons. Meanwhile, a third wave of air attacks on Iraq has been ordered for today, this according to a senior U.S. official. Western missiles directly hit the headquarters of Iraq's Military Industrialization Commission in the second night of airstrikes against what the U.S. said were suspected defense and intelligence sites. Twisted metal and broken, blackened concrete on top of the 10-story building mark the point where U.S. or British weapons slammed through its roof and tore through its interior to the ground floor. More than 100 United Nations relief workers left Baghdad today for the safety of neighboring Jordan, leaving just a skeleton staff in Iraq. Chief UN humanitarian officer in Iraq, Hans von Sponeck, said his staff were no longer able to carry out their work monitoring distribution of humanitarian supplies bought by sanctions hit Baghdad under its oil for food accord. UN humanitarian staff working to alleviate the worst impact of sanctions, which have caused the deaths of 1.5 million people, are mainly involved in overseeing distribution of food and medicine bought under the Oil for Food Accord. This news from Texas. The United States is nearing its 500th execution since resuming capital punishment in 1977, and many more are certain to follow despite international condemnation and intense national debate. If it all goes as scheduled, the dubious milestone will be reached this evening when Andrew Smith, 38 years old, is killed by lethal injection in South Carolina for the 1983 murder of two people. And that's some of the news.
It started in slave ships.
Slave ships. There are more records of slave ships than one would dream. It seems inconceivable until you reflect that for 200 years ships sailed carrying cargo of slaves.
Man, man, be non-violent. In the face of the violence that we've been experiencing for the past 400 years, is actually doing our people a disservice. In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman here with my co-host Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day, Amy. And to all of our listeners, we're back on day two of this atrocity here abroad and at home that we're facing in the country.
Well, I just can't begin to fathom all that's happening. Again, the House underway with the debate on impeachment that will lead to a vote, a foregone conclusion, it looks like at this point. At the same time, we see this continued bombing of Iraq. I was watching Madeleine Albright yesterday, the Secretary of State, talking about how she cared about the Iraqi people. And I was thinking about the interview that Leslie Stahl of 60 Minutes did with her a while ago, a year or two ago, asking if it was worth the price, the sanctions costing 500,000 Iraqi children's lives. Was it worth the price? At that time, Madeleine Albright says, yes, it's worth the price. And today she's saying, as the U.S. is raining these bombs down on Iraq, that she cares about the Iraqi people. I mean, the contradictions are quite amazing. And then yesterday all day watching the debate, which can't be called a debate, in the House around House Resolution 612, the supporting of the military efforts in Iraq, the supporting of the U.S. airstrikes in Iraq, wasn't a debate at all. Just one Democrat after Republican after Democrat after Republican getting up and saying that they supported the president in his efforts.
Right, and it is amazing that after all of the ruckus in the first evening of the bombing by so many Republicans, when it came down to an actual vote on whether they were going to support this military action, they virtually all fell into line, as they always do when it comes to these foreign interventions or attacks by the United States, whether it's Panama or Grenada or so many others that have occurred in the past. They inevitably all fall in line supporting this continued role that the United States has anointed itself with as a policeman of the world.
That's right. In fact, not just the Republicans almost retracting statements on the part of the leadership, Dick Armey, Trent Lott, Senate Majority Leader, questioning the timing of the U.S. attack, you know, questioning its timing along with the impeachment. They seem to be retracting that yesterday. But also the surprise of the liberal Democrats. It seems that while I've been away from Washington, there was some construction underway in the House, a new architecture where the aisle has been removed. There is no two sides of the aisle. In fact, the House resolution passed almost unanimously. There were five people who opposed the U.S. strikes against Iraq. Five people. Those five people included John Conyers, Democrat of Michigan, Colorado Democrat David Skaggs, Barbara Lee of Berkeley, just trying to remember them as we go, because I was surprised at who
Cynthia
wasn't on
McKinney, wasn't it?
Cynthia McKinney of Georgia. She has opposed the U.S. strike against Iraq. So you have Barbara Lee, Cynthia McKinney, John Conyers, David Skaggs, and Ron Paul of Texas, the Libertarian. Now, who's not on that list? Maxine Waters' fierce support for the president. Who's not on that list? Bernie Sanders voted for.
Charlie Rangel, who has always voiced in the past some opposition to some of these adventures, amazingly. I think part of this, the problem here again, is that it was almost as if loyalty to the president in this, in his impeachment battle, was equated with loyalty to him on the question of his decision to make this attack, so that many of these folks felt that they would show disloyalty to the president at a time when he was needed to vote what I'm sure many of them realized was an unnecessary resolution of support.
Well, meanwhile, as all of this is happening, late in the afternoon, we learned that Bob Livingston, the House Speaker-elect, and by the way, Newt Gingrich opened the session yesterday morning. He handed the gavel immediately over to the House Speaker-elect. He gave a speech, no surprise, for the U.S. strike against Iraq and walked out. Looks like it'll be his last time opening the session. And we learned that the House Speaker-elect, Bob Livingston, has had a number of affairs. I mean, this got so surreal by the end of the day. And watching CNN last night, I couldn't help but laugh, because the reason this story has come out, he was forced to admit this in the Republican conference meeting last night because it was about to come out. So he announced to the people, the Republicans around him, that I have strayed from my marriage on occasion, whereupon they all stood up and gave him a standing ovation. Well, they might say to show their support for him, but that is too funny for words, just that alone.
If our foreign affairs has become wag the dog, then our domestic affairs has become Baywatch and One Life to Live joined together.
Well, and let me say, on the wag the dog issue, 2 days ago was the first anniversary of the preview of the first showing, the premiere of Wag the Dog. But on this Livingston issue, on CNN, they started off by saying a reputable news source has said that, you know, is going to reveal that Bob Livingston had these affairs. And throughout the evening, I did not hear them once then, after early on, someone asked a reporter, you know, what was it? They said Hustler. Yes, folks, Larry Flint and Hustler was the magazine that was revealing this. Throughout the rest of the evening, though, I did not hear that referred to. Once I heard one of the news anchors say it might have been a skin magazine, but that was it, talking about the reputable news media. You know, Juan, as a responsible journalist, I thought I'm reading all the stuff I should be. I get my National Enquirer religiously. I keep up to date with the National Star because I have to keep up on the news. I just hadn't been reading Hustler, and there is where I have fallen short. I have to say I surprised the newsstand vendor this morning when I came in, got my Washington Post, got the New York Times, got the New York Amsterdam News, and then I said to him, where's Hustler? He said, what? I said, listen, I have to be up on the news events of the day. But I thought that my colleague Robert Knight at Pacifica Station WBAI said it very well yesterday as we were sitting together watching the House so-called debate on the support for U.S. strikes against Iraq. He listened to Republican after Democrat after Republican show their support for Clinton in their testimonies. And Robert Knight said, well, based on the testimonies we have heard today in Congress, it is clear Monica Lewinsky did not act alone. Well, we're going to deal with a lot of issues today, a lot of issues that are very serious. We're going to begin with Gerald Horn. Gerald Horn, who is a professor at the University of North Carolina, has been following both the impeachment developments closely and now in these last few days following what's happening in Iraq. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Horn.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
What are your thoughts today as we enter this debate on impeachment?
Well, if we step back and take a deep breath and try to take a historical point of view, I think we see that one reason for the bitter partisan wrangle that's taking place in Washington, D.C. right now is that you have the confluence of two of the epical events of U.S. history. I'm referring to the Civil War and the Cold War. The Civil War, of course, involved the Confederates trying to secede from the Union, but they were defeated militarily but not politically, and so you see spearheading this impeachment debate are Southerners, unreconstructed Southerners like Trent Lott of Mississippi, Bob Livingston of Louisiana, and Tom DeLay of Texas, and they perceive Bill Clinton of Arkansas as being on the wrong side, particularly of the racial debate. And if you look at the Cold War, this effort to bring down the Soviet Union, once again, that was spearheaded by right-wingers, particularly Southerners from the South. And they perceive Bill Clinton as being on the wrong side of that debate as well because of his viewpoint against the Vietnam War, for example, and his viewpoint with regard to anti-war protests. And so it seems to me that, once again, we see reflected in this debate one of the most ticklish and prickly issues of U.S. politics, which is the dominance of the right wing. And even if you get rid of Bill Clinton, and even if you ascribe this terroristic bombing campaign in Iraq as somehow peculiar or unique to Bill Clinton's political problem, we can't escape the fact that it's the right wing that's driving the political debate in the United States. Until that's done with, we're always going to be faced with crises of one sort or another.
Gerald Horn, I'd like to, following up on that, because I've often remarked about that we sometimes it escapes us that the complete political leadership of the country, including Bill Clinton, obviously has been from the South now for many years, and even passing of the mantle from Newt Gingrich to Bob Livingston maintains it within the southern boundaries. But the also that that they perceive Clinton almost as a southern traitor, somebody who seems to be controlled by northern liberals, as they see it, even though he's a southerner. And even as I understand it, many of the Democrats who now are leaning toward voting for impeachment are southerners, aren't they? It would be very interesting for folks to take a tally when the final vote occurs sometime tomorrow, of how many of these Southern Democrats also join forces. As you say, there's still this continuing remnant of this battle, this Civil War battle, and the forces that are driving this, the Southern Christian fundamentalist forces seem to be at the core of the constituency driving this morality play as it's developed in the country. How do you see this working out when it reaches the Senate? Because it's my sense that the Democrats themselves do not want to go through this process of a Senate trial, and that despite what Trent Lott said yesterday that there will be no deal, that there will be a trial. Do you have a sense that once this vote occurs, that there will be immense pressure on Bill Clinton to do very much as Professor Eric Foner told us Andrew Johnson did in his impeachment, which was basically cut a political deal to cave into the policy demands of the Republicans in order to save his skin?
Well, Bill Clinton has already caved into the policy demands of the right wing by engaging in this terroristic bombing campaign of Iraq. But according to this morning's Washington Post, basically what the Republican right is going to do after impeachment is flip the script. In other words, the Democrats have been saying all along that this country should be spared this agony of this impeachment debate. After Clinton is impeached, the Republicans are going to argue, yes, the country should be spared this agony, and so Clinton should resign. There's going to be a drumbeat of voices calling for the president to step down. This, of course, is consistent with the Republican rights campaign all along, which is to continually move the goalposts. At one time, we were told that all he had to do is express contrition and apologize, and this thing might go away. Of course, Clinton began groveling shamelessly in apologies, but that, of course, did not abate the cry for his political head. And so it seems to me that the next stage in this national drama will be this wrangle over whether or not the president should step down. And then after he steps down, if that is to happen, of course, the next stage will be campaign finance violations being leveled at then-President Al Gore. I don't think that we're even close to the end of this drama concluding.
Gerald Horn, we have to break for stations to identify themselves. And when we come back, we'll also be joined by Tariqa Lee from Britain. We're going to be also talking about just which military contractors are benefiting from the U.S. airstrikes against Iraq. And we're going to look at the issue of depleted uranium. Depleted uranium, not only in Iraq, but right here at home, and how it affects people in the United States. Gerald Horn is a professor at the University of North Carolina. I want to follow up with one question about Trent Lott and his ties to white supremacist groups, since he will be presiding over, not presiding over, but he will be the Senate majority leader in the Senate that tries President Clinton if the House impeachment vote goes as expected. Stay with us.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood and ink of the headlight and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you think that you've heard it before, how governments lie to their people and how nations are driven to war. There are shadows on the faces of the men who fan the flame. To those wars that have fought in places we can't even remember their name. On the radio, talk shows, and TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom and how we come to the aid of a friend. Well, who are these ones we call our friends? These governments killing their own? Or is it the ones who can't take anymore, so they pick up a brick or a gun or a stone?
There are lives in the balance. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, here with Juan Gonzalez, our guest, University of North Carolina Professor Gerald Horn, and in a minute, Tariq Ali, joining us from London. There has been a couple of stories, and we're going to be following up on this next week, about Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott and Georgia Republican Congressmember Bob Barr, who sat on the House Judiciary Committee, a real stalwart, one of the earliest ones calling for the impeachment of President Clinton, about their involvements, Trent Lott and Bob Barr, in these successors to the White Citizens Councils of the South. In fact, Trent Lott being named Man of the Year by the successor of this white supremacist group. Gerald Horn, a quick comment on this.
I think that what this reveals is that we are not being hyperbolic when we talk about the danger of a fascist threat in the United States of America right now. This so-called CCC, or Citizens Conservative Council, this direct descendant of the White Citizens Council, is basically the Ku Klux Klan in suits and ties. And we'd be remiss if we sought to downplay this. This is a very serious matter, and quite frankly, if anything, we should be calling for the resignation of Trent Lott and Bob Barr right now rather than President Clinton.
Yes, Citizens Conservative Council, their webpage, which I was able to examine a couple of days ago, is amazing in terms of the editorials and the articles that it calls for there, basically saying that Abraham Lincoln was elected by socialists and communists, that openly railing against racial mixing as bringing down Western civilization and the white race. And also one of their newsletters took credit when they named Trent Lott Man of the Year for having been able to secure his one vote majority to become Senate Majority Leader, because they claim that they have enough influence among Southern Republicans to have been able to swing that election in his favor. Now, they may be blowing their own horn a little bit more than is real, but the fact is that Trent Lott's spokespeople have said that when he did speak in front of the group once about 10 years ago, he really wasn't aware of what their principles were all about. But the reality is he has spoken before their groups more than once and has been named Man of the Year. So he's very familiar with the group, what the group stands for.
And Georgia Congressman Bob Barr also said he wasn't that familiar with the group. And the Washington Post interviewed a member of the group, and they said that wasn't true. Last comment, Gerald Horn.
Well, I think that those who do not live below the Mason-Dixon line, who do not live behind the Cotton Curtain, oftentimes underestimate the extent to which the Civil War is still a live issue in the South. You have monuments to Confederate generals all over the place, dotting the landscape in this part of the country. And basically, these are monuments basically glorifying people who sought to overthrow the U.S. government in order to preserve slavery and most likely participated in a conspiracy to assassinate and murder President Lincoln. Now, this basically suggests in modern-day terms that an attempt to overthrow the government from the right is always a live issue and is never irrelevant and never wrong. And I think that helps to shed light on these proceedings that are going to be unfolding in Washington, D.C. in about a half hour in terms of the impeachment of the President of the United States and overturning two national elections.
Well, Gerald Horn, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Gerald Horn is a professor at the University of North Carolina, director of the African American Research Center there. Thank you. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Hi, my name is Catherine Miller from Tarzana, California. And my comment is that I supported President Clinton against the impeachment process, not from a personal perspective, but in not wanting to slow down the running of the country over the president's personal life, which didn't seem appropriate to for impeachment. It didn't seem what the Founding Fathers had in mind. And after the bombing began yesterday and it continued today in Iraq, and it becomes more and more apparent that this was a part of a process of avoiding his impeachment, I have completely turned any support that I had toward President Clinton completely away.
And that was one of the many listeners who have called us over the last few days, and we'll be playing people's comments. We've also been getting many faxes of people telling us what they're doing around the country. There have been protests in New York. Thousands of people turned out yesterday at Times Square protesting the U.S. bombing of Iraq, a vigil to observe the National Day of Mourning for the victims of the sanctions on and bombings of Iraq will be held on Saturday, December 19th. I got this fax from the Fellowship of Reconciliation in Troy, New York. It's an event that's also sponsored by Peace Action. Again, we've been getting these faxes and calls over the last 24 hours almost nonstop, and we'll be playing more and more of these. But we turn right now to Tariq Ali, writer and broadcaster based in London. His latest novel is The Book of Saladin, published by Verso, a book about the Crusades, the war between Christianity and Islam. He's also a longstanding editor of the New Left Review. And as we turn to you, we turn to what is happening right now in Iraq. And I thought, Tariq Ali, we should start off with the name of the operation, the name of the operation that's going on in Iraq right now, the hundreds of missiles that are raining down on Iraq as a result of the U.S. and British militaries. It's called Operation Desert Fox. Who was the original Desert Fox?
Well, the original Desert Fox was, of course, the nickname given to General Erwin Rommel, one of the leading Nazi generals in Hitler's army, who crossed the desert to try and take the British colonies in the Middle East away from the British. And the Desert Fox was an affectionate nickname given to him by his British opponents, and I find it very entertaining, if not grotesque, the fact that this particular operation has been named after a fascist general.
It's quite amazing. I think people should remember that all over this country, that Operation Desert Fox. The Desert Fox originally comes from the Nazi Rommel and his attempts to take over North Africa and the Middle East for Adolf Hitler.
Tariq Ali, I'd be interested in what has been the reaction among the progressive movements in Britain to this continued slavishness of the British government now in its labor form to American foreign policy?
Well, I think the progressive movement, for what it's worth, is deeply hostile to it, but it's very small and very isolated. In Parliament, there are only 20 members of Parliament opposed to this. The Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, and Blair's own forces backed him without question. Unthinking, blind, unquestioning obedience to leader Tony Blair. In Europe, of course, Blair is completely isolated. Most of the European governments, I mean, the Germans are being more cautious, but the French are enraged. The Italians are angry. Most of the Scandinavian countries are very cross at what's going on. So within Europe, Blair and Clinton are totally isolated, but that doesn't bother Blair particularly because the majority of the establishment, the media establishment, which he courts assiduously, Rupert Murdoch, Conrad Black, are very strongly in favor of the Atlantic Alliance, and their newspapers are giving him full support. And I'm afraid, I have to say this, that we live in a very, very dumbed-down culture for the last 3 or 4 years now. International coverage on the mainstream networks and radio channels has been very sort of limited. So you are basically talking to a population which has been fed on soap operas of one sort or the other. And the bombing of Baghdad is presented every night like a virtual soap opera. We witness in a voyeuristic way the skies, night skies lighting up over Baghdad, and then the commentators talk, and there another cruise missile is gone. And the obscenity of this seems to escape the people who are presenting the news and talking about it. It's a very depressing situation. I mean, lives, human lives, are being lost in Baghdad, at the same time as it all appears one is living in a one-party state in Britain, because there's such unanimity that it's frightening.
I should say at this point, we understand at least what's being said on television. I would expect it's more than this, 25 people dead in Iraq and dozens of casualties. It's hard to believe, actually, the number is that low. Each life precious, but 25, it's hard to believe, especially from in our country, an administration that doesn't talk very much about the, quote, yeah, enemy dead.
Yeah. No, I think there's obviously that the casualties are higher, and I think both sides, for their own reasons, want to underplay them at the present time. Saddam Hussein doesn't want to indicate that he's incapable of defending his population, because that reduces his own credibility. I think the casualties must be much higher. I mean, yesterday's reports were that a United Nations building housing United Nations employees came very close to being bombed. So the notion that we now have weaponry which is so efficient that it only hits where it's pointed at is, of course, a complete joke and a very sick joke at that.
One of the most astounding bits of information that the Pentagon released yesterday was that they are deliberately not targeting those factories or installations that they believe may be involved in the production of chemical and biological weapons, because they fear creating a situation of mass murder within Iraq. So you have a situation where we're ostensibly attempting to limit Saddam's capacity to wage to produce weapons of mass destruction, but the only thing we are not hitting are his installations that
you're absolutely
weapons
right
of mass destruction. Now, it boggles my mind. So then what are we doing?
I think what Britain and the United States are doing is inflicting a punishment beating on a country as a whole. They want to punish the dictator, who, after all, is their own creation, like so many other dictators the world over, and who went out of control, or so they think. And they want to punish him, but they can't actually get their hands on him. So they're punishing him by bombing the city in which he lives. And the bombing of the city is actually punishing the people of Iraq who have suffered long years now from these sanctions. I mean, I think it's worth remembering that no defeated country has been treated like this by the West.
Tariq Ali, I'm going to interrupt because we have to go to the House floor right now,
okay,
where the House reading clerk, Paul Hayes, is reading the articles of impeachment, and he is up to Article 2.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has willfully corrupted and manipulated the judicial process of the United States for his personal gain and exoneration, impeding the administration of justice, in that, one, on December 23, 1997, William Jefferson Clinton, in sworn answers to written questions asked as part of a federal civil rights action brought against him, willfully provided perjurious, false, and misleading testimony in response to questions deemed relevant by a federal judge concerning conduct and proposed conduct with subordinate employees. Two, on January 17, 1998, William Jefferson Clinton swore under oath to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in a deposition given as part of a federal civil rights action brought against him. Contrary to that oath, William Jefferson Clinton willfully provided perjurious, false, and misleading testimony in response to questions deemed relevant by a federal judge concerning the nature and details of his relationship with a subordinate government employee, his knowledge of that employee's involvement and participation in the civil rights action brought against him, and his corrupt efforts to influence the testimony of that employee. In all of this, William Jefferson Clinton has undermined the integrity of his office, has brought disrepute on the presidency, has betrayed his trust as president, and has acted in a manner subversive of the rule of law and justice to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, William Jefferson Clinton, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. Article 3. In his conduct while President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton, in violation of his constitutional oath, faithfully to execute the office of President of the United States, and to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in violation of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has prevented, obstructed, and impeded the administration of justice, and has, to that end, engaged personally and through his subordinates and agents in a course of conduct or scheme designed to delay, impede, cover up, and conceal the existence of evidence and testimony related to a federal civil rights action brought against him in a duly instituted judicial proceeding. The means used to implement this course of conduct or scheme included one or more of the following acts. One, on or about December 17, 1997, William Jefferson Clinton corruptly encouraged a witness in a federal civil rights action brought against him to execute a sworn affidavit in that proceeding that he knew to be perjurious, false, and misleading. Two, on or about December 17, 1997, William Jefferson Clinton corruptly encouraged a witness in a federal civil rights action brought against him to give perjurious, false, and misleading testimony if and when called to testify personally in that proceeding. Three, on or about December 28, 1997, William Jefferson Clinton corruptly engaged in, encouraged, or supported a scheme to conceal evidence that had been subpoenaed in a federal civil rights action brought against him. Four, beginning on or about December 7, 1997, and continuing through and including January 14, 1998, William Jefferson Clinton intensified and succeeded in an effort to secure job assistance to a witness in a federal civil rights action brought against him in order to corruptly prevent the truthful testimony of that witness in that proceeding at a time when the truthful testimony of that witness would have been harmful to him. Five, on January 17, 1998, at his deposition in a federal civil rights action brought against him, William Jefferson Clinton corruptly allowed his attorney to make false and misleading statements to a federal judge characterizing an affidavit in order to prevent questioning deemed relevant by the judge. Such false and misleading statements were subsequently acknowledged by his attorney in a communication to that judge. 6. On or about January 18th and January 20th and 21st, 1998, William Jefferson Clinton related a false and misleading account of events relevant to a federal civil rights action brought against him to a potential witness in that proceeding in order to corruptly influence the testimony of that witness. 7. On or about January 21st, 23rd, and 26th, 1998, William Jefferson Clinton made false and misleading statements to potential witnesses in a federal grand jury proceeding in order to corruptly influence the testimony of those witnesses. The false and misleading statements made by William Jefferson Clinton were repeated by the witnesses to the grand jury, causing the grand jury to receive false and misleading information. In all of this, William Jefferson Clinton has undermined the integrity of his office, has brought disrepute on the presidency, has betrayed his trust as president, and has acted in a manner subversive of the rule of law and justice to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, William Jefferson Clinton, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States. Article 4. Using the powers and influence of the office of President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton, in violation of his constitutional oath, faithfully to execute the office of President of the United States, and to the best of his ability, preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, and in disregard of his constitutional duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, has engaged in conduct that resulted in misuse and abuse of his high office, impaired the due and proper administration of justice and the conduct of lawful inquiries, and contravened the authority of the legislative branch and the truth-seeking purpose of a coordinate investigative proceeding, in that as president, William Jefferson Clinton refused and failed to respond to certain written requests for admission, and willfully made perjurious, false, and misleading sworn statements in response to certain written requests for admission, propounded to him as part of the impeachment inquiry authorized by the House of Representatives of the Congress of the United States. William Jefferson Clinton, in refusing and failing to respond, and in making perjurious, false, and misleading statements, assumed to himself functions and judgments necessary to the exercise of the sole power of impeachment vested by the Constitution in the House of Representatives, and exhibited contempt for the inquiry. In doing this, William Jefferson Clinton has undermined the integrity of his office, has brought disrepute on the presidency, has betrayed his trust as president, and has acted in a manner subversive of the rule of law and justice to the manifest injury of the people of the United States. Wherefore, William Jefferson Clinton, by such conduct, warrants impeachment and trial and removal from office and disqualification to hold and enjoy any office of honor, trust, or profit under the United States.
The resolution constitutes a question of the privileges of the House and may be considered at this time. The Chair would like to read an announcement to all members. Today, the House will embark upon a resolution of impeachment of the President of the United States. The Chair would take this occasion to make an announcement regarding proper decorum during debate in the House during the pendency of the impeachment resolution.
This is Speaker
Pro Tem. As the Speaker announced with
Republican
the concurrence
Ray
of the Minority
Mahoney.
Leader on September 10, 1998, during the pendency of proceedings in impeachment as the pending business on the floor of the House, remarks and debate may include references to personal misconduct on the part of the President. While limited references in debate to the personal conduct of the President are allowed, the stricture against personally offensive references is not totally disabled. To the contrary, this exception to the general rule against engaging in personality admitting references to personal conduct when that conduct is the very question under consideration by the House is not limited. The point was well stated on July 31, 1979, in the analogous circumstances of a disciplinary resolution, including a sitting member. While a wide range of discussion is permitted during debate, Clause 1 of Rule 14 still prohibits the use of language which is personally abusive. This is recorded in the Detchler-Brown procedure in the House of Representatives in Chapter 12 at Section 211. While the impeachment matter is pending on the floor, the chair would remind members that although the personal conduct of the president is at issue, the rules prohibit members from engaging in generally personal, abusive language toward the president, and also from engaging in comparisons to personal conduct of sitting members of either House of Congress. The chair asks and expects the cooperation of all members in maintaining a level of decorum that properly dignifies the proceedings of the House. The chair recognizes the gentleman from Illinois.
Mr. Speaker, I ask unanimous consent that, members
have
five legislative days in which to revise and extend their remarks on the resolution under consideration. And I ask unanimous consent during consideration of House Resolution 611. The previous question shall be considered as ordered on the resolution to final adoption without intervening motion, except 1. Debate on the resolution shall be extended to. Now, I have 4 hours here, Mr. Conyers, but that's certainly negotiable. And I would welcome any suggestions you might have on time. But for purposes of this motion, I ask that the debate be extended to 4 hours, equally divided at the outset and controlled by the chairman and ranking minority member of the Committee on the Judiciary, and 1 motion to recommit with or without instructions, which, if including instructions, shall be debatable for 10 minutes, equally divided and controlled by the proponent and an opponent.
Reserving the right to object.
Gentleman from Michigan.
Thank you,
Michigan
Mr. Speaker.
Michigan Democrat David Bonnier.
Thank my colleague for his request, although I don't thank him that much. The gentleman has just handed to us on our side of the aisle the request that has just been, he has just read, and we have just looked at it, and we have a number of concerns about it. And if I might proceed for just a second, Mr. Speaker, I'd like to enumerate our concerns and then yield, if I could, to my distinguished colleague, Mr. Conyers, for any comments that he might have.
Bonnier is a Democratic
minority
whip.
Obviously, because we don't believe we should be here today while our men and women are fighting abroad. And we have expressed that in the first motion of the day with respect to adjournment. We don't believe this is a proper time to be debating removing the Commander-in-Chief while thousands of men and women are fighting abroad.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
Secondly, Mr. Speaker, and Mr. Hyde, the gentleman asked for 4 hours of debate. I've just done the math briefly here. That comes out less to 30 seconds per member. We don't think that is a reasonable amount of time for members of this body to express themselves on perhaps one of the most important issues that they will face in their lifetime. And thirdly, it runs this time problem that the gentleman has raised, the 4 hours, runs to the fairness issue. And we note that in your unanimous consent request, there is nothing here to give the American people a chance to see this Congress vote on the option that they would like to see that would bring this country together, the option of censure. Much of our argument goes to the question of fairness, And we have grave, grave concerns about agreeing to this request based on the arguments that have just been made. And I would yield, if I could, to my colleague from Michigan, Mr. Conyers.
First of all, I want to indicate
John
my
Conyers, Michigan
concurrence
Democrat.
In the position raised by Mr. Bonnier. But is there any reason why, Chairman Hyde, we could not wait for 2 days before proceeding with this very serious undertaking until at least our brave soldiers may be out of harm's way before we proceed?
Well, if the gentleman is yielding to me for an answer, I would like to say,
Republican
first of all,
Henry
on
Hyde.
The time, the 4 hours, I said that's negotiable. I wouldn't expect to limit it to 4 hours. Limit it to some reasonable sum. We offered a lot of hours last night that you rejected. So we're trying to be fair. And on the time, I ask you for your suggestions. As to holding this for a couple of more days, that's a decision that our conference has made. We felt the quicker we could go ahead, the more we could show the world our democracy works.
I object.
Interestingly, Conyers voted against the House resolution supporting the U.S. strike against Iraq.
Mr. Speaker,
is there objection to General Lee for all members? Without objection, the gentleman from Illinois is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, for purposes of debate only, I yield the customary one-half time to Mr. Conyers, and all time yielded is for the purpose of debate only, and I yield to Mr. Sensenbrenner.
The gentleman from Wisconsin is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, if the previous question is moved, I intend to vote against it so that I may be recognized to control time under the hour rule in order to continue debate on House Resolution 611.
That was Wisconsin Republican James Sensenbrenner, also on the House Judiciary Committee. John Conyers
is
the ranking member of the House Judiciary Committee.
Without objection, gentleman is recognized.
Mr. Speaker, my colleagues of the People's House,
Republican Henry Hyde,
I wish to talk to you about the rule of law. After months of argument, hours of debate, there's no need for further complexity. The question before this House is rather simple. It's not a question of sex. Sexual misconduct and adultery are private acts and are none of Congress's business. It's not even a question of lying about sex. The matter before the House is a question of lying under oath. This is a public act, not a private act. This is called perjury. The matter before the House is a question of the willful, premeditated, deliberate corruption of the nation's system of justice. Perjury and obstruction of justice cannot be reconciled with the office of the President of the United States. The personal fate of the President is not the issue. The political fate of his party is not the issue. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is not the issue. The issue is perjury, lying under oath. The issue is obstruction of justice, which the President has sworn the most solemn oath to uphold. That oath constituted a compact between the President and the American people. That compact has been broken. The people's trust has been betrayed. The nation's chief executive has shown himself unwilling or incapable of enforcing its laws, for he has corrupted the rule of law. The rule of law by his perjury and his obstruction of justice. That and nothing other than that is the issue before this House. We have heard ceaselessly that even if the President is guilty of the charges in the Starr referral, they don't rise to the level of an impeachable offense. Well, just what is an impeachable offense? One authority, Professor Stephen Presser of Northwestern University Law School, said, and I quote, "Impeachable offenses are those which demonstrate a fundamental betrayal of public trust. They suggest the federal official has deliberately failed in his duty to uphold the Constitution and laws he was sworn to enforce," close quote.
Ben. Now, the chair realizes that members will want to conduct conversations on the floor, and I would ask those members to take their conversations to the cloakroom.
Speaker Pro Tem,
because I know
Ray
when
LaHood,
members
Republican
are speaking,
of Illinois.
They will want to be heard. Gentlemen may proceed.
Back to
and
House
so
Judiciary
we must
Chair
decide.
Henry Hyde.
If a president, the chief law enforcement officer of the land, the person who appoints the attorney general, the person who nominates every federal judge, the person who nominates to the Supreme Court, and the only person with a constitutional obligation to take care that the laws be faithfully executed, can lie under oath repeatedly and maintain it is not a breach of trust sufficient for impeachment. The president is the trustee of the nation's conscience, and so are we here today. There have been many explosions in our committee hearings on the respective role of the House and the Senate. Under the Constitution, the House accuses and the Senate adjudicates. True, the formula language of our articles recites the ultimate goal of removal from office, but this language doesn't trump the Constitution, which defines the separate functions, the different functions of the House and the Senate. Our founding fathers didn't want the body that accuses to be the same one that renders final judgment, and they set up an additional safeguard of a two-thirds vote for removal. So despite protests, our job is to decide if there is enough evidence to submit to the Senate for a trial. That's what the Constitution says, no matter what the president's defenders say. When Ben Franklin, on September 18, 1787, told a Mrs. Powell that the founders and framers had given us a republic if you can keep it, perhaps he anticipated a future time when bedrock principles of our democracy would be mortally threatened as the rule of law stands in the line of fire today. Nothing I can think of more clearly illustrates that America is a continuing experiment, never finished, that our democracy is always a work in progress, than this debate today, for we sit here with the power to shape and reconfigure the charter of our freedom. Just as the founders and framers did, we can strengthen our Constitution by giving it content and meaning, or we can weaken and wound it by tolerating and thus encouraging lies under oath and evasions and breaches of trust on the part of our chief executive. The president's defenders in this House have rarely denied the facts. They have not seriously challenged the contention of the independent counsel that the president did not tell the truth in two sworn testimonies. They have not seriously attempted to discredit the facts brought before the committee by the independent counsel. They've admitted, in effect, he did it. But then they've argued that this does not rise to the level of an impeachable offense. This is the so what defense, whereby a chief executor, the successor to George Washington, can cheapen the oath, and it really doesn't matter. They suggest that to impeach the president is to reverse the result of a national election, as though Senator Dole would become president. They propose novel remedies like a congressional censure that may appease some constituents and certainly mollify the press, but in my judgment betray a lack of seriousness about the Constitution, the separation of powers, and the carefully balanced relationship of checks and balances between Congress and the President that was wisely crafted by the framers. A resolution of censure to mean anything must punish, if only to tarnish his reputation. But we have no authority under the Constitution to punish the President. It's called separation of powers. As you know, we've been attacked for not producing fact witnesses. But this is the first impeachment inquiry in history with the Office of Independent Counsel in place. And their referral to us consisted of 60,000 pages of sworn testimony, grand jury transcripts, depositions, statements, affidavits, video and audio tapes. We had the facts, and we had them under oath. We had Ms. Lewinsky's heavily corroborated testimony under a grant of immunity that would be revoked if she lied. We accepted that, and so did they. Else, why didn't they call any others whose credibility they questioned as their own witnesses? No, there was so little dispute on the facts, they called no fact witnesses and have even based a resolution of censure.
You've been listening to
Hot Talk from Cal Poly. This is California State Polytechnic University here in Pomona, California. My name is Saul Land. Hour of Hot Talk with my guest today, Mary Tong, who directs
of royal absolutism. We're the heirs of a long tradition of parliamentary development in which the rule of law gradually came to replace royal prerogative as a means for governing a society of free men and women. We're the heirs of 1776 and of an epic moment in human affairs when the founders of this republic pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honors. Think of that sacred honor to the defense of the rule of law. We are the heirs of a hard-fought war between the states, which vindicated the rule of law over the appetites of some for owning others.